a site of great concern and sadness. Russia says the images are staged, but Ukraine and its Western allies accuse Russia of being behind such atrocities in Ukraine, with the U.S. president once again calling the Russian president a war criminal that should be tried. But what about U.S. and its allies' atrocities committed in other parts of the world like Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, or Iraq? Can those be dismissed just as collateral damage? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the double standards there and ulterior motives that the U.S. may have when it comes to the Ukrainian conflict. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have Ian Williams, international affairs analyst, who joins us from New York. Also joining us, Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist, who joins us from Bristol.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Ian Williams, and ask you about what we have seen on Bucha and the way that it's been covered and what has occurred there. Ukraine accuses the Russian military of massacring hundreds of civilians there. Russia denies the killing of civilians and argues that the images of dead bodies have been staged. What do you think?
Yes, the Russian military almost certainly massacred hundreds of civilians there. If their calling card, we have satellite imagery showing the bodies in the street. We have eyewitnesses seeing the bodies. We have the bodies themselves with bullets in them. We have them in the side of Russian bases. So this is a slam dunk, and no amount of protestation from Sergei Lavrov, who I knew at the United Nations and used to have more credibility than this, because he used to confess to disquiet at what the Serbs were doing, but then stood up and defended them. And now, yes, there are double standards. Yes, when Joe Biden calls for international war crimes trials of Putin and the Russians, he is quite right, as long as he says this applies to others as well, as long as it applies to the Israelis over what they did in Gaza and Lebanon. But he protects them all of the time. And this is where the United States has consistently disarmed itself and also disarmed the United Nations human rights mechanisms. Because by showing it was willing to use its veto on behalf of a proxy state, Israel, it's giving sort of carte blanche or carte blanche to the Russians to do the same. It's very difficult to put your hand on your heart and say they must be prosecuted. It's a war crime. But those aren't war crimes because they're our allies doing it, and we've been covering for them all along. And this is the fundamental hypocrisy of the situation at the moment. It's interesting watching... What we see here is very much like what we saw in Grozny. Look at those pictures of Grozny, where the Russians went to liberate the Chechens again. And now those liberated Chechens are coming and visiting the same damage on the people around Kiev and in Ukraine. There's atrocity after atrocity. And
right.
Trying to pretend that our side's atrocities don't matter, but theirs do, is really... It's as bad as it's worse than a crime. It's stupid.
Well,
because it means you're laying yourself open, which is what Biden's doing.
Let's break this open a little bit more. Obviously, first we need to get an idea of both sides. Tony Gosling, the Russian president, had just came out a few hours back accusing Ukrainian authorities of actually being behind this, what he has called crude and cynical provocations. If you can describe what he may mean by that, and he said this was an assessment as it was described. Again, of Kiev regime's crude and cynical provocation in the city of Bucha. What does he mean by that?
Well, look, you're very privileged because here in the West, we are not getting any balanced coverage. It's great to have someone to discuss and debate this with. putting both sides, as should have been being put on Monday at the UN Security Council, except the British chair of the Security Council stopped that discussion even happening. So that, of course, is what the Western media need for a propaganda blitz on one side. I think, you know, very few of us were actually in these places at the time. And only those who were and who have access to the evidence can really make a decision and a judgment one way or the other. But I think the likelihood is, considering we had a two-day gap between when the Russians pulled out of Bucha and when these allegations were made, including with the mayor actually making no mention of this as well in the interim, so that apparently this hadn't happened in the meantime. These are bits of evidence which all need to be put together if there is to be any kind of... But I would suggest what's going on here is yet another Western provocation and accusations being thrown, which at the moment it doesn't seem to me as if there is the really strong evidence one side or the other committed. We know that we have Azov battalion Nazis roaming around on the Ukrainian side, and it is absolutely possible that they are using things like sabotage, false flag, manipulation to manipulate the Western press in the propaganda war, because although the Russians seem as if they're much stronger on the ground, in the information war, I'm afraid the Russians, as Sergei Lavrov himself admitted, are really small players, and they're very, very much behind the curve. And so the NATO countries, the Western press, think that they can win through propaganda. And of course, the problem with that is if you don't get these sorts of events, the so-called Russian atrocities, which may be and maybe Ukrainian atrocities, if you don't get the Western press interrogating these, what then happens is you can create the situation where NATO, who I believe are very much involved in Ukraine, although they like to hold their hands up and say, no, nothing to do with us. And I've got a lot of evidence for NATO carrying out atrocities through Gladio, basically picking up from the Nazi werewolves in World War II, that they may well be involved. The problem is, if this is allowed to not be interrogated in the Western press, the way it's been, this kind of what you might call propaganda blitz, blaming the Russians, when we don't really know, there's been no proper investigation yet, right, these headlines will stick in people's minds. And the thing is that these kinds of things may be used in the future to give, through the media, the West's NATO countries an excuse to get involved. Say, well, look at this atrocity. Now it's time. We must act. We must actually send NATO troops in. And, of course, we all know where that could lead.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about what you mentioned there, what Tony Gosling mentioned there, Ian Williams, about the UK. We're looking at how there should be an investigation that Russia has called for a UN Security Council meeting on this. But the UK blocked it. Why do you think the UK did that?
I think the UK blocked it in disgust, absolute disgust. And for once, I agreed with this British government at the bravado and the chutzpah of the Russians committing a massacre and then saying, oh, look what they made me do. Let's get it straight. There was one day between the Russians leaving, fleeing, by the way, because they were defeated by the locals who hate them. They fled. Then reporters came in. I know some of those reporters personally. They would not lie. What did they see? They saw bodies that had visibly been lying there for days. Their fingers are black and rotten. They are buried in the earth. There are satellite pictures showing those bodies for 3 weeks before, during the Russian occupation. Independent private satellites were taking pictures. The Americans could probably provide better ones because they have better definition, but it was a private company. Other reporters came in and saw it. They went round them. Locals went in. We have eyewitness testimony from locals saying the Russians came and shot my wife, my husband, shot my children, or were doing this, that, and the other. You've got the actual Russian bases with the Russian MREs scattered around and the vodka bottles, lots of vodka bottles, which they looted from the houses, and the corpses next to them buried in their bases. I mean, this is so slam dunk. I'm very glad that Tony Gosling has at last had the temerity to admit there's a possibility that the Russians might have done it. This is a slam dunk, and it is a war crime. And yes, there are other war crimes. No amount of whataboutery about Dyacin, Sabra and Shatila, what's happening in Yemen. I agree with all of those. But I have been party at the United Nations for almost 20 years at the attempt to operationalize the International Criminal Court of Justice. I supported it against Milosevic. I supported it against the Sudanese in Darfur. And I support it now against the Russians. I would also support it against the Americans if they did Milei. It was a friend of mine who broke the story of Milei, the American atrocity. But none of us ever said, what about? What about? And that is really the big cry that the Russians keep producing. They did this in Grozny before. They have committed unspeakable atrocities against their own people in the civil war.
Okay.
And well, this is their calling card. Look at the pictures of Grozny. Look at the pictures of Kiev, and you see. It almost says, thank you, Moscow, on the bottom of that postcard.
Well, we need to talk about the past here. Tony Gosling, you can take your pick here. I have some that I noted here. Haiti, where there were indiscriminate killings of Haitians under direct command of a U.S. officer going back decades ago. Obviously, we're looking at what happened after World War II and the Pacific War, as it was called. And it was quite interesting, some of the stuff that came out of this. The Korean War, the No Gun Rye Massacre, all of these involve U.S. and all of these involved what many say are war crimes, with hundreds and hundreds were killed. Of course, the more recent ones, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, and Iraq. Which ones would you like to put into perspective for us?
Well, I'd like to look much more closely at what's been going on in Europe since the Second World War, particularly the CIA, once it was created. Their support for Ukrainian Nazis as part of the US Cold War effort, the idea of false flags, very much in the NATO intelligence pocket right the way through the 1980s in order to stop the Italians bringing in a communist government. Operation Gladio in Italy saw the far right in Italy actually blowing up individuals in squares and various places around Italy and blaming it on the communists. So the idea was that the far right could actually kill Italian people within Italy and then try and blame it on the Russians. Well, many people in Italy did believe it. Many people didn't. They even actually assassinated Aldo Moro, as well, Prime Minister. So there's been a big load of activity from the NATO intelligence services right throughout Europe. The same sort of thing going on in Belgium, by the way, when the Belgian government tried to reject US cruise missiles. And the actual pedigree of these far-right Operation Gladio forces, as many people don't know this, but at the end of the Second World War, the SS created, the Nazis created stay-behind forces that they called werewolves. Their job was to create sabotage behind enemy lines as the Allies advanced towards Berlin. And the same tactics have been used to stay behind forces, weapons caches, this sort of thing. They couldn't resist using them, and so they used them for political purposes. I think what we're looking at now is almost like the most recent phase, the most recent stage of this, quite possibly, using the same sort of tricks. And the big culprits for me are the Western press. We had, for example, no interrogation today as the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, called for the Russians to be, the Orthodox Church in Russia, to be expelled from the World Council of Churches. What they didn't tell us, that actually Rowan Williams, even though he was Archbishop of Canterbury, was initiated into the Order of Druids, which is completely the opposite of the Christian Church. And so what you had, the farce of a Druid telling the world that the Russian Orthodox Church should be ejected from the World Council of Churches with no interrogation, no background whatsoever in the Western press. So I think there's a very powerful, a very big campaign right across the Western press to demonize Russia. Paul Burrell, the former French intelligence officer, he actually called it, he said the secret code name in NATO is Operation Beluga, the idea being to discredit Russia, to discredit Putin. And of course, the idea is here that they can then get away with all sorts of stricter measures and even a potential move to a third world war against Russia if Russia can be discredited in this way. I think that's what we've been seeing over the last few days with these provocations, but I may be proved wrong. I don't like to try and come to conclusions before we've had evidence from both sides and a proper investigation.
Indeed, something that doesn't seem to actually come into fruition at this point. So Ian Williams, our guest there from Bristol, Tony Gosling, talks about the fact that both the U.S. and NATO in turn or maybe after something bigger in terms of the way that they are going after Russia. I mean, Russia at this point is the most sanctioned country in the world. I'm not too sure how much more damage they can do to Russia. Of course, economically, there's still some more damage they can do. What I'd like to ask you, and Williams, is in the area of negotiations. There was a particular interesting article coming out from the Washington Post that said that NATO says Ukraine to decide on peace deal with Russia, but with limits. Now, that raises question marks here. Why would there be limits on how Ukraine negotiates with Russia?
Look, I don't think the Washington Post is speaking for the government in Washington, let alone the government in Kiev. And what we've just heard is a long list of completely circumstantial, occasionally accurate diatribes about NATO. No fan of NATO, no fan of the United States. Completely think that Mylae massacre should be prosecuted and dug up again. Yes, Dia Yassin and Sabra and Shatila should be prosecuted. Yes, Gaza should be prosecuted. This should be prosecuted. We have Russian troops on a sovereign United Nations member's territory. They went in unprovoked with no, there are no Ukrainian troops on Russian territory. They massacred. We have evidence, unashamed evidence from the Russians that they have used weapons of mass destruction against civilians in the cities. They've blown apart Kiev. They've blown apart the rest. So anything about Second World War preparations, werewolves, gladio, it's about as relevant as introducing the Roman gladiators into the proceedings. Yes, people were killed then. People are being killed now by Moscow. They're being killed in defiance of international law.
Well, that's
it is a crime of aggression for the Russians to go into Ukraine. It is a war crime and a violation of the Geneva Conventions to shoot prisoners, to shoot civilians. They have such a charge sheet against them. And no amount of bleating and counter-accusations. They have not shown any evidence
but
that the Ukrainians...
But when there are possibilities of talks... when there are possibilities of talks, you don't think that this is true? That perhaps that NATO, and I should say the U.S. Leading the way, have motives that this resolution cannot come about unless we really deal a heavy blow to Russia?
No, they've said quite strongly that it's up to the Ukrainians. It's the Ukrainians who are saying we cannot agree to terms while these evil cutthroats have a knife at our throats, are raping our women and blowing up our children.
But they've said
that's a fairly reasonable position,
myself. They have said issues of global security are at stake here, and you can't just give concessions. They've blatantly said that. So Zelensky's...
Whose concessions? Somebody comes into your house, he grabs hold of your daughter, holds a knife to her throat, and then asks you why you're not conceding and being reasonable. Where is the justice in this? I think there's something missing in the state of balance. Whataboutery has gone mad here. It really has. You do not invade somebody else's country and then blame them for imposing conditions on talking to you. You get out of there and you say, we were wrong, and we will prosecute those responsible, Putin and the generals who committed these atrocities.
Well, Tony Gosling, what do you think? I mean, again, the reports out there, and this is not the first time, but for it to come out blatantly and say this, that, Zelensky can't come out and give concessions because, as the Western backers, they have called it, have said that any settlement to this war can't be done because there are larger issues of global security at risk. And I'm guessing that maybe is perhaps pointing to China. What do you think, Tony Gosling?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, China is sitting and watching this from the background. They very much got the Russians back because the United States has been provoking over there too. Of course, the US has been provoking Russia in Ukraine. It's quite obvious. We had the Munich Security Conference just before the Russians invaded with Zelensky threatening to arm his army with nuclear weapons. The Russians can't just ignore that. We've also seen, by the way, today, the latest sanctions on Russia are that to stop the use of Russian coal. Now, we in Europe, we're wondering, well, OK, so we can't use Russian coal. I'm sure You know, Prince Charles and the rest of them, the climate people, will be very pleased about that. But this benefits the US. If there's no Russian energy coming into Europe, the United States can jack up the prices of the energy it is selling to Europe. So I think we should look at this maybe as a, you know, in part anyway, as a kind of overreaction to what Russia's done in order to benefit US energy companies. In fact, I've seen over the years energy being used more and more in these sorts of discussions. As when it comes to talks, I would like to see, very much like to see, the basic demands of Putin met. That is to say, very simple, Lugansk, Donetsk and Crimea to give up the claim on those, because there was a war going on there anyway in these breakaway republics. Much better to say, well, let's give up your bombing of these places and let's just have peace there. And the other thing was just to guarantee that they wouldn't join NATO. Why on earth can Zelensky not do that? And I'll tell you why. It's because he is reading a script written in Washington. This is actually what it looks like to me.
Zelensky
is
has said
US,
he's prepared to give
US
up
wants to sacrifice
NATO.
Europe. Let me finish my sentence and then you can have your say. The US wants to sacrifice Europe to weaken Russia, because Russia is the only power in the world that really 100% has the moral high ground and stands up to the United States. Oh. Now, at least at last, that there's been some kind of retribution for all of the NATO activities, and they say they're not there, but they are, okay, in Ukraine, doing things like encouraging these Azov battalion Nazis. This is obviously a provocation to Russia, and you know they cannot allow the situation to develop as developed
invading
before
another country isn't a provocation.
When the Russians were invaded and they had a basically a crisis as to whether Russia was going to exist or not, they Russians can't allow that situation to develop again.
Let's bring in Ian Williams. Ian Williams, go ahead.
I mean, there's some complete absence. This is Alice in Wonderland stuff. Did Ukraine turn round to Russia and say, you must leave the Shanghai Cooperation Pact? No. It was Russia's decision to do what it wanted. Did it even say, by the way, you should get your troops out of Moldova, out of Georgia and the other places you've occupied? No, it didn't. It stayed in its own territories. It didn't invade, and it has now been invaded. And we're talking about parity and how the Ukrainians must make concessions. This is right back to 1941. Why didn't Stalin just give up the Ukraine to Hitler then? And he could have had peace, perhaps. Or Winston Churchill. He was offered by not my favourite person, but the Germans basically said to him through back channels, you kiss and make up with us and we'll let you have the British Empire still. He said, no. It's one of the few things I admire about him. He said, no, you do not knuckle under to dictators and invaders. And
that's the
position Ukraine and the Nazi invaders from Russia, who are Nazis in every way. They kill children. They kill people. They kill prisoners. They bomb cities. They are evil. Ruling class
let's
in
give
Russia
30 seconds.
And need to be dealt with.
Sorry, let's give 30 seconds in closing to Tony Gosselin. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, these are sort of ridiculous provocations, calling the Russians Nazis. We have real Nazis right now in Ukraine. The Azov battalion really do support Adolf Hitler. And they use the same sort of provocative tactics as well. That is to say, they like to create false flags, like the false flag that started the Second World War, the Gleiwitz incident, where the Nazis actually grabbed POWs and poisoned them and made it look as if to the world's press it was the Poles who were behind it.
I apologize for that, Tony Gosselin. Tony Gosselin there, historian and investigative journalist. Ian Williams, thank you for your input. International affairs analyst from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tapwayes, goodbye until next time.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before. Through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint.
A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. In this episode, we are trying to criticize the movie Inferno. This is a 2016 American action mystery thriller film directed by Ron Howard as one of the sequels to the previous two movies that we talked about, The Da Vinci Code, as well as Angels and Demons. This seems to be the later sequel to the last two movies that we criticized in previous episodes. It is based on a novel, a 2013 novel of the same name by Dan Brown, basically. Starring Tom Hanks, Felicity Jones, the late Irfan Khan. You know, he's passed a few years ago. Well, and it is directed by Ron Howard. The two movies that we criticized before. The whole story is, about, again, the symbologist, Tom Hanks, Robert Langdon. After waking up with amnesia in a hospital, he teams up with Serena Brooks, Felicity Jones, in the movie, one of his doctors, to protect the world from the evil plan of a mad scientist. Before asking our two guest speakers further questions, Brother Hossein and Sayyid Abdullah, let's listen to a short part of the movie and then we'll be back.
There's a switch. If you throw it, half the people on Earth will die. But if you don't, in 100 years, the human race will be extinct. I left you a path. The hardest one yet. Only you can finish it. You are humanity's final hope.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting, and my guest speaker, Brother Hossein and Sayyid Abdullah. Brother Hossein, salam alaikum, and welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam, glad to be here.
Welcome. And Sayyid Abdullah, salam alaikum, welcome to the program.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And Brother Hossein, the budget for this movie was $75 million, yet the box office is $220 million. And Rotten Tomatoes give this movie, Inferno, an approval rate of 23%. The average rating of 4.60 out of 10. And Metacritic gives it a rating score of 42 out of 100. In comparison with the previously criticized movies like Angels and Demons as well as The Da Vinci Code, this seems to be like less well received, don't you think so?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I didn't like it as much as the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it was like kind of rushed, but you know, still I like the story mm-hmm. behind it, and
yes.
Of course the actors were pretty good too. But overall, it wasn't executed very well.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Sayyid Abdullah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Being a very big fan of Dante myself,
mm-hmm.
It was okay. It was mm-hmm. good. So obviously the box office speaks for itself.
Yes.
And surprisingly, considering the fact that it was made in 2016, in fact, it's pretty much Corona itself now. So it's prediction of Corona.
Kind
or,
of.
Or not actually a prediction, but I mean, they're foretelling it was going to happen. Because it's basically the same thing. So it was quite good, in the sequence of events, done pretty well.
I see.
Yeah. So they kind of measured everything mm-hmm. correctly, especially if you try to apply it to now.
Yeah. Exactly. I see. Okay. Yeah? Fine. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back And after that, we'll ask the relevant question to the part that we played.
Tell them humanity is the disease. Inferno is the cure.
Back to the program, Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting, and my dear guest speakers, Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah, in the studio with us. We are criticizing the movie Inferno, produced in 2016, directed by Ron Howard. This is the sequel movie to Angels and Demons and The Da Vinci Code. Brother Hussein, the character says mankind is cancer in its own body. Humanity is the disease, and Inferno is the cure. First of all, what does it mean? And second of all, under this pretext that somebody just tries to use and utilize, for example, one technology or one virus coming out of scientific labs to disperse it throughout the world and kill as many people as possible to just balance the population on the earth, so to speak. Can one kill, like, mass number of people to save others if they are able to, if they are capable, scientifically speaking? Can scientists, do so because of population explosion, for example?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course not. There are certain rules and guidelines that, and ethics that, everyone has to follow. And, who is this guy or who are the scientists who want to control the population? Who do they think they are? I mean, mm-hmm. They can't play God with other human lives, right?
Right.
This guy was obviously very sinister, and he had this evil plan that he wanted to execute, on his own will, and he didn't really consult with any other people about it.
Right.
And obviously, it's wrong. Even if he got to the conclusion that he has to do this or that he was the chosen one, at the end of the day, it wasn't right because it wasn't. The choice wasn't his.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break by listening to another part of the movie, Inferno, directed by Ron Howard, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
It's Botticelli.
It's his map of hell. He painted it as an illustration of Dante's Inferno. I studied Dante when I was younger.
Probably in kindergarten.
I was a bit obsessed.
Dante defined our modern conception of hell. Our vision of it hasn't changed since he defined it 700 years ago. Botticelli drew it, but Dante created hell as we know it.
This is what I have been seeing. Torment. Sinners. Branded with letters. Liars covered with rashes. Soothsayers with their heads ripped backwards. Serpent.
The punishment for thievery.
Back to the program Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah, my two guest speakers in the studio, criticizing the movie Inferno. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, I know that you also said that you're in favor of Dante, and probably you have read his works, such as The Divine Comedy.
Yeah.
And not to mention, Inferno means hell, right? Yeah. Right. It is actually derived from Dante's Divine Comedy.
Yeah.
Well, the map of, as given the map of Dante's hell, our modern conception of hell hasn't changed from 700 years ago. Mm-hmm. Like the sort of concepts and notions we have from hell and heaven basically stay the same as being mentioned in the movie too, like from 700 years ago. Is that really true? What's hell like? Can we say the kind of hell that Dante tries to portray somehow is tantamount to the type of hell that we have in religions?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. With Dante's Inferno in the Divine Comedy, and Inferno was just the first part of Divine Comedy. So it was very intriguing that how he drew the nine circles.
Mm-hmm.
And each circle is basically a sin begins. He begins with limbo and he moves to lust and all other sins. And it's obviously it's his journey from hell to mm-hmm. paradise,
yes.
Through the purgatory, which I think purgatory, or as we call it, barzakh, it made its first known into the Christian world, I think, through Dante's. Before that, purgatory wasn't something that was mentioned. So it's quite intriguing. That's why I kind of got...
You mean we didn't have any concept of purgatory in Christianity?
Not before Dante.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so after Dante, they started to have that purgatory concept, which was very intriguing. And reading mm-hmm. Dante's journey, I could relate to so many of it in our Islamic textbooks. Because at the end of the day, it's your sins and it's you. So you move on through your own hell rather than anything else. So mm-hmm. even though, that part that says humanity is a cancer, right? And only Inferno can cure it. So if you burn yourself from within
mm-hmm.
and you can get rid of all this sins and this material attachment,
yes.
obviously you will be saved.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at Dante and his Inferno, it hasn't changed because the concepts are still the same.
Right.
The sins are the same. And obviously the punishments are still the same. And whether Muslims or Christian or what have you, if we go to the afterlife, or purgatory at least,
yes.
We will have to face these sins. So we will move, even God himself, for example, will question you based on certain sins. Now, Dante got stuck with seven circles. With us Muslims, I think we have 50 circles
mm-hmm.
because we have 50 major sins that will lead you to hell. So you need to navigate through these 50 circles instead of Dante's seven. So Dante was very limited to, obviously, because he wasn't moving very much from a religious perspective. Obviously, the guys he was outcasted, he was in love, and he was trying to get to his, what's her name? Patricia?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
Patrice.
So he was going through a lot of emotional stage himself. So, like I said, he was stuck with seven circles.
Mm-hmm.
And these seven circles, like I said, they haven't changed because they're very relevant to, especially through religion, they're always relevant because we have the same sins that they keep repeating themselves and obviously the same punishment that you will get.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, Dante's envision of the punishment of each circle is not going to be the same as what Allah has prepared.
Yes.
But it will be, at least there's a punishment for each sin, nevertheless.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see it kind of moves up with time, and it's still a classical, I don't know what they call it poetry. To me, it's not a poetry. To me, it's just a magnificent book
mm-hmm.
Explaining what hell could be or what you could be facing.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he might have wrote it in a poetic form back in the day,
I see.
But it's a very entertaining, a gripping book to read. When it comes to trying to explore that world through the vision of Dante himself. So what got me actually very intrigued is the fact that he was looking at a lot of things from an Islamic perspective mm-hmm. too. I mean, even though...
I see.
Like he hadn't, went in depth, but I can see that he was going through with the main lines of Islam and the Islamic idea of hell.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein, for your nice contribution to program... Viewpoint, the movie critique program on IRIB English Radio. We try to criticize the movie Inferno, produced in 2016, but we haven't finished it yet. We ask you humbly, me and the rest of the crew here from the studio and, from the IRIB English Radio, to keep us in your du'as, especially in this holy month of Ramadan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Dante's Inferno.
Dante defined our modern conception of hell 700 years ago. Why Dante? Why this map of hell?
Someone created a plague.
Without Professor Lennon, no one could find the virus.
Oh my God.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak are fighting for their political lives. This after it emerged both men were amongst dozens to receive fines from the Met for their part in Partygate, the series of gatherings that took place during the height of COVID restrictions in and around the corridors of British power. Labour leader Keir Starmer led the chorus of voices urging them to go.
But the guilty men are the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. They've dishonoured all of that sacrifice. They've dishonoured their office. This is the first time in the history of our country that a Prime Minister has been found to be in breach of the law. And then he lied repeatedly to the public about it. Britain deserves better. They have to go.
The Chancellor has issued a statement giving his unreserved apologies over the matter. The Prime Minister, however, attempted an explanation of sorts.
There was a brief gathering in the cabinet room shortly after 2 p.m, lasting for less than 10 minutes, during which people I work with kindly passed on their good wishes. And I have to say, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. But of course, the police have found otherwise, and I fully respect the outcome of their investigation.
Johnson's critics feel the Prime Minister not only failed the British people with his leadership during the peak of COVID, but continued to do so with these fresh revelations.
I'm stunned. In all British history, no Prime Minister has ever been fined by the police before. And this is a law he introduced, that we all spent 2 years basically in self-isolation. And he's just having not just one party, but about a dozen of these parties. And for somebody who makes the law, who is our Prime Minister, to then break it so many times, he shouldn't just be resigning from office. He should be going to prison.
The support being shown to the Prime Minister and the Chancellor will be of cold comfort to those who lost loved ones during COVID. And the apologies of both men will ring hollow to those who managed to make the ultimate sacrifice and who are now wondering why those who made the rules seemed incapable of following them. Amina Taylor, London.
It's the second time in 7 months that Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein has visited Tehran. The Iraqi diplomat's trip came upon an invitation by his Iranian counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdullahian. The two-hour talks were held behind closed doors, but from what the joint presser suggests, regional security topped the discussions.
We appreciate the role played by the Republic of Iraq in maintaining regional understanding. We also talked about Syria and expressed our opposition to the fact that parts of Syria are still occupied by military bases of other countries without seeking permission from Syria's central government. We also talked about Afghanistan. Iran and Iraq welcome an all-inclusive government in Afghanistan that encompasses all ethnic groups.
Iraq has been mediating talks between Tehran and Riyadh over ways to resume diplomatic ties between the two regional rivals. After more than 5 years of icy relations, Iran and the Arab Kingdom stand on opposition sides in the Saudi war on Yemen, which has been ongoing since 2014, with Iran calling for a ceasefire. The Iraqi foreign minister says a fifth round of talks due in mid-March was suspended, calling on both sides to quickly resume the discussions.
Iraq and Iran's security is tied to the security of the region, so Iraq will continue to play its part as a mediator for dialogues between Iran and Saudi Arabia to hopefully bring the two countries back to diplomatic relations.
The Iranian foreign minister, for his part, thanked Baghdad's constructive role in brokering the Saudi-Iranian talks, saying Tehran is ready to come back to the negotiating table.
We thank efforts made by the Honorable Prime Minister and Foreign Minister of Iraq to resume Saudi-Iranian talks. We welcome this initiative. When it comes to the Saudi war in Yemen, we believe that a sustainable ceasefire, the removal of the humanitarian blockade, and a Yemeni-Yemeni discussion without any foreign intervention could help the Yemeni people decide their fate.
Iraq and Iran are close political and security partners. This partnership was best manifested during the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq, when Tehran helped dislodge the terror group there. But when it comes to trade ties, both sides agree that they need to do more, putting the current bilateral trade volume between the two countries at roughly $14 billion. The two sides now agree to take steps to at least double this figure.
Tehran and Baghdad's ties are basically defined by security cooperation. But let's not forget that Iraq was among the countries that maintained their economic cooperation with Tehran in the peak of U.S. sanctions on Iran. Now, this last visit is seen as another step forward in the two sides' trade and security cooperation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Uncertain times for millions of Brits. A sharp spike in the cost of living combined with stagnant pay rates mean many are counting the pennies and being forced into making stark choices.
I've got a broken back right now with metal screw and bone in my back. And the pain with the arthritis I've got is horrible. And the cost of living, of electric and gas and petrol and food, is horrible. You know what I have to do? Go from shop to shop to buy cut price things which is on sale.
There's going to be people out there that are too afraid to switch on a kettle for some hot water. You know, that kettle is going to cost me 46p to boil. No. No one should be living like this. This isn't the Stone Age. I'm not going down a mine this afternoon. This is 2022.
The signs for British householders have been ominous. Interest rates hitting a record high of 6.2% earlier this year, supply issues associated with Brexit, the global impact of COVID, a spike in energy costs, the crisis in Ukraine, and a hike in national insurance contributions have all contributed. Food bank use amongst working people has hit record highs, with ever more falling into debt, according to published figures. There's a growing sense of frustration and desire to cast blame.
What the government is doing, the government has to look into this matter. They should think that what the common people will do, what they will do, they cannot survive in this country.
I'm appalled that we are left in this situation. We've just came through 2 years of COVID, and now, by the way, people, here you go, energy cap. It feels like the government is like, oh, well, you've just came through hell. Here's a little bit more.
The terrifying reality is that for millions of Brits, this is simply the beginning. Flash forward a few months when temperatures would have plummeted and savings, if any, depleted. We'll start to see a real rise in half-empty fridges and bare cupboards and a growing sense of desperation, despair and anger. Boris Johnson's government says it's doing more than any other administration to lift Brits out of poverty. On recent evidence, there will be millions who wholeheartedly disagree. Amina Taylor, London.
As a neighboring country, Iran has always been a second house for Afghans. Over 5 million Afghan refugees are living in Iran today. Following a stabbing attack at Imam Reza Shrine in Mashhad that left two clerics dead, the Afghan society condemned the move, extending messages of solidarity and sympathy with the Iranian people.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has been a kind host to millions of Afghan refugees for more than four decades. Iran provides our Afghan legal and illegal refugees with jobs as well as educational, medical and other facilities. I wish Iranians enjoy peace and condemn any attack on their country, as it has served as a second home for Afghan people.
I extend my deep condolences to the Iranian people over the barbaric attack on a number of clerics at Imam Reza Holy Shrine. Not only me, but also the whole Afghan nation were saddened after the attack. The enemies of Islam and the two nations are pushing conspiracies to sow sedition, but we won't let anyone to ruin our solidarity.
Afghans also echo Iran's voice against enemies' plots and Cold War. Experts say neither the knife attacker in Mashhad represents Afghans, nor allegations of Iran mistreating Afghan refugees are true. They believe enemies of the two nations are using the media to sow discord.
The Mashhad incident that left two clerics dead was orchestrated by Takfiri groups and the enemies of Iran and Afghanistan. We should be aware that how they are trying to target our friendship. The stabbing attacker never represents the Afghan people, but it was meant to push Afghanophobia in Iran. On the other hand, the West is sowing Iranophobia in Afghanistan by fake viral pictures, while we know that Iran is generously hosting Afghan refugees.
This comes as the two nations are expanding relations in different political, cultural, and economic areas. The two neighboring countries, Iran and Afghanistan, have long been close partners. People here thank Iran for peacefully housing millions of Afghan refugees. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Britain has made its pro-Ukraine stance clear, with the flag of Kiev fluttering atop several government buildings in Whitehall. Yet it was still a surprise when UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson popped up alongside Vladimir Zelensky for a walkabout in the near-deserted streets of the Ukrainian capital. The mutual political backslapping seems at odds with the reality of the crisis, but Johnson pledged further military support, including 120 armored vehicles and anti-ship missile systems.
Together with our partners, we are going to ratchet up the economic pressure, and we will continue to intensify, week by week, the sanctions on Russia. Not just freezing assets in banks and sanctioning oligarchs, but moving away from use of Russian hydrocarbons.
Back in London, the optics were not as glossy.
Well, I think Boris Johnson is engaging in a propaganda exercise designed to manufacture consent for prolonging a war, which a proxy war, that is, which is unwinnable. And rather than indulging in this sort of publicity exercise, he ought to be focusing, in my opinion, on diplomacy to bring the war to an end.
Boris Johnson has pledged further support to Kiev in the shape of military hardware and by ramping up the anti-Russian action. It's also been mentioned that the Prime Minister might have taken this crisis as an opportunity to bolster his conflict credentials. But what of the voices urging a de-escalation and not adding fuel to this international fire? Well, many argue they won't be found here in the corridors of British power.
Britain's role in the conflict, especially its supply of more armaments, has not brought the result it perhaps hoped.
Well, it doesn't help the people of Ukraine, and nor does it help the people in this country or indeed across Europe. The strategy which is being pursued by NATO is entirely counterproductive. I mean, they're heading potentially towards a wider conflagration, maybe a third world war.
At the heart of this conflict is a wider issue, one Zelensky reminded Johnson.
If we were in NATO, this war wouldn't have happened. Or it would have unfolded differently. You would have the shoulder of close neighbours, strong neighbours, or we could all fight together. And probably war would not happen.
Until real diplomacy prevails with Moscow and Kiev thrashing out their regional affairs, publicity tours like the ones undertaken by Britain's Prime Minister will only do so much. Amina Taylor, London.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories, mainly in the northern West Bank city of Jenin in the last few days. Israeli forces have shot dead several Palestinians in separate incidents, including two women in less than 24 hours. On Monday, 17-year-old Palestinian teenager Mohammed Zakarni succumbed to injuries he sustained during an Israeli military raid in Jenin. This came as Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has granted all military and security forces full freedom of operation. The Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs considered Bennett's statement as an order to kill Palestinians.
It's an order to kill. It's a war crime, actually, and a crime against humanity of the Palestinian people. Israel is trying now to escalate the situation in the occupied Palestinian territory to consolidate its apartheid and colonial regime in the occupied Palestinian territory using all the illegal measures, including the extrajudicial killing.
As Israeli forces continue raiding Jenin and the surrounding towns, Palestinian resistance groups in the city announced a state of alert and called for general mobilization of their activists to confront the Israeli military incursion. Protests have also been held across the occupied West Bank in solidarity with Jenin and its residents. Moreover, the Israeli military forces have maintained their presence across the occupied West Bank. Experts warn that they will also escalate a crackdown against Palestinians and use even more excessive force to fight the Palestinian resistance.
We are facing an escalation of events. The smell of a new intifada rises. Numerous funerals for Palestinians in several areas due to clashes taking place in friction points and sites. One can tell an escalation is expected on all fronts, which might then lead to the return of calm.
Tel Aviv has been stunned by a string of deadly operations in the last weeks. 14 Israelis, including soldiers, have been killed. Since then, tensions have risen sharply. The Israeli army has stepped up its daily raids and arrests in an attempt to crack down on the spiraling violence.
It's obvious that Tel Aviv is heading toward another heavy-handed crackdown against Palestinians in the occupied territories and specifically in Jenin. But Palestinians who have been confronting military raids warn such crimes and escalation could, at the end of the day, set off a new intifada or popular uprising against the regime. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Families of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and prisoners' rights activists held a sit-in outside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. Palestinian prisoners see no end in sight to their suffering, as hundreds of them are being held without charge under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. According to Palestinian human rights groups, the Israeli regime has issued over 50,000 administrative detention orders against Palestinians, including women and minors, since 1967.
My message for the international community is that they must put their efforts against the policies of Israel that result in suffering of our prisoners, and we wish freedom for them and all the prisoners.
According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, Palestinian prisoners are subjected to harsher treatment in Israeli detention centers during the holy month of Ramadan.
During the month of holy Ramadan, the Israeli occupation deprived the Palestinian detainees from organizing the collective prayers like Taraweeh and Fajr prayers. And also the food is not enough. They provide the meals with bad quantity and quality.
Solidarity with Palestinians.